Big ol' Marcus.
Oh, dude.
Big ol' Marcus.
Right here.
Welcome back to the Native Ways Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Ellis.
I'm your co-host, Christian Miller.
And today, we're bringing y'all a pretty neat episode. Many of y'all will be familiar with this guy, but we'll kind of talk about that here in a minute.
Yeah, so I just want to shout out our socials. So, TikTok, Instagram, all that good stuff. If you just want to go ahead and give us a follow, subscribe, and especially YouTube, you can see this video now if you're watching it. Just hit that subscribe button and like the video. That would help a lot. We appreciate everything that y'all do to support us, and hope you like this one.
Yeah, we want to thank Texas Cash, Ryan Murray over there, for all he's done. Y'all check that out. Go subscribe. Get you a year subscription, quarterly published magazine. Only one in Texas, one of the few in the United States, so go check it out. Shout out Dancing Dogs Ranch. And yeah, we're going to get into this. Today we got Michael Boutwell with Monolithics.
What's going on? Actually, let me change that. What's going on, Arrowhead friends?
If y'all have seen his stuff, you should know that.
Yeah, if you just want to kind of give us a little rundown of yourself, where you're from, who you are, what you represent.
Sure. So my name's Mike. Mike Boutwell, as you already mentioned. I am a property manager, is what I do professionally. Not a lot of people know who I am, or I never show my face, put my name out there. And I've been doing that business for about 10 years. I've been in real estate and property management, just that whole business, for actually around the last 20 years. But as far as what I do on the side for the whole Monolithics and the Arrowhead stuff, I started Monolithics about 5 years ago. So it would have been November of this year. It'll be 5 years ago. And, you know, I'm just a guy. The simplest way to put it is a guy who loves the constant pursuit of lost North American, specifically Texas, history. And we just happen to live in one of the best places in the United States to do it. And that is why I don't have any kids. So for me, it's a little easier, you know, to get out there and have the extra time outside of work. You know, my slogan is, if I'm not working, I'm digging. And outside of work, I literally try to dig as often as I can, because it is literally my favorite thing to do in the world. I just, any extra little bit of time I have, I go out there and dig. Whether it's hand digging, or whether it's going on a professional pay dig, you know, I'm out there trying to do it. And, you know, we're blessed to be here in Texas, you know, just because of the amount of sites we have here. With the river systems coming out of the Gulf and all the tributary creeks that run out of those rivers, it's just nonstop camp after camp.
Yep.
So we're just blessed to have what we have here with the selection and the material source, as you guys know.
Yep.
You know, Texas is full of different materials from east to west, north to south. We've got it all. So anyway, you know, I'm just a simple guy out there, man, who loves artifacts. Outside of work, I'm just in the ground. I'm an armadillo. I'm in there as much as I can, man.
Armadillo Boutwell.
That's it.
Yes, sir. So kind of what got you into digging?
So I have always loved lost history. You know, when I was a kid, you know, just the idea of ships off the coast that sunk with treasure lying in the ground. You know, I've always loved the idea of archaeology in general. Just where did we come from? You know, where did we, you know, advance to as a society? Where did we come from? What are the steps that we took from the past to get to where we are today? And just to see the changes in technology. So how I got into Arrowhead specifically, when I was about 14 years old, my dad lives in the Texas Hill Country. He lives out in between Tarpley and Utopia. Which is bullseye for some of the best stuff in the world.
Yeah.
And my dad was a PA for Utopia, and he retired. And he's been a PA for he was a PA for many years. Before that, he was EMS. And being the PA in a small town, you know everybody, and you got connections with people. So when I was 14, he came up. He had some of his best friends at the time were that he was doing a lot with at that time were also into being outdoors. And anyway, he asked me, he said, hey, I got this connection to go onto this ranch. He goes, would you like to go do some arrowhead digging? And this was off a ranch, the first place I ever went. I said, absolutely. So the first place we ever went to was a huge ranch off the Sabinal River, which I didn't know anything about arrowheads, nothing. So we went out to this ranch, and we hand dug about, I got to go out to that ranch maybe 4 or 5 different times total. And I was living in Austin. My mom and dad were divorced from many years ago. So I would split time between my dad and my mom, but I was living in Austin. So the few times I got to go hand digging, I got to go to that ranch maybe 4 or 5 times when I was, you know, hanging out with my dad, when I had spending time with my dad. And this is a ranch that we all dream of. It had the deep part of the Sabinal running through it, huge pecan and oak trees, I mean, all over it. It's, in today's money, you're talking something that's going to be, you know, probably $50, $60 million ranch at least. Mm-hmm. Massive. And back then, in the early 2000s, you know, when I was 14, we got to go out there and do the hand digging 4 or 5 different times. Well, it was an extremely rich site. So the first time I ever put a tool into the ground, I had no idea what I was doing. So I got to go out there, and we hand dug, you know, maybe like 5 times total. And I found at least, you know, a frame or two worth of really cool artifacts, you know, including what my dad found. And we didn't touch literally maybe 2% of what, kind of like what you were just talking about a little while ago.
Yeah.
Maybe 2% of what that entire ranch had. And that was one specific site off that ranch. There was multiple camps on that place. And so when I was, I want to say 14, I might have been like 15 or 16. But during that time in the early 2000s when I went out there, that's what got me started in arrowheads. My dad got the hookup. He knew the guy. He was a ranch hand. He got us on the ranch. Went out there, and we had a good time, you know. And like anything else, all good things come to an end. Well, we kind of lost access because the ranch hand went elsewhere, and my dad's connection, you know, we just lost that connection, so we never got to go back to that ranch. So after about, I'd say, 15 years went by, I kind of just stopped. You know, I got the opportunity, and I didn't do anything in that gap in that entire time. So like 15 years goes by, and then in about 2014, going into late 2014, I kind of, with an old friend of mine who I knew growing up, he kind of started telling me about these, you know, I kind of started wondering about the arrowhead world again. And he just told me, you know, there's these pay digs you can go on. I had no idea what these things were. So 2014, it started. I went to my first pay dig, and from there I hit the ground running pretty hard. And so the last 11 years from 2014 to now, I've been digging pretty dang hard.
Yeah.
All over Texas, a lot of different sites. I'd probably say at least, I have a map of Texas I put went to Hobby Lobby. I bought an old map of Texas that's divided by county. It's got all the river systems that run through it. And I put a pin on every place where I've dug.
I might have to do that.
It's a good visual, especially when people, you know, walk into your house and they're like, so what do you do? Well, let me show you where I go and what I do. Gives them a good visual. And I'd say there's at least 45 to 50 different pin locations on there now, of you know, scattered through mainly central, out into the hill country, some out in West Texas, a few out in Southeast, but you know, the main areas that got a bulk of our stuff.
Yeah.
And anyway, man, that's how I got started. The friend reconnected me in 14. For namesake, I'll keep these guys private, but got reconnected and hit the ground running, and it's just been nonstop ever since, man. It's been a blast.
That's awesome. That's cool to hear. Like I said, I mean, I want to do that now with the map, because one of my favorite things about digging artifacts is seeing the different sites. I mean, I think it's so cool. You go on a pay dig, and you know, some of them you never know what you're going to pull up to. You know, you might pull up to somebody's backyard, or you might pull into thousands of acres of property and driving past beautiful creeks and river bottoms and all that. And that's probably my favorite part about it, especially when you get down in the hill country. You never know what you're going to see.
Absolutely.
That's cool.
Yeah, so do you have any recollection of the first point you might have found, or not necessarily type, maybe just even what it might have looked like?
The one that I remember the most was off that ranch that my dad took me to when we first started digging. I popped out a little paddle drill.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I remember. I can't tell you if it was the first artifact that came out of the ground, but that's the one I remember from that place. And the reason I tell you that site would have been an Indian Creek Twin Elm all over again, like you were saying at the other place. My dad was dating a girl at the time, and she was a slow digger. I mean, she would get in there like with the toothbrush type of digger, like she didn't even know what she was doing really. She found one of the finest curvel knives out of that place I've ever seen. And I didn't really know too much at that time what she had, but now that I know what I know now, I know what she had.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. So the quality was exceptional.
Yeah.
At that particular ranch on that one site.
Yeah.
It would have been a dream for all of us to be able to run pay digs off that place, you know, to allow other people to come in. And to this day, I think still most of that ranch is just untouched. I think it's owned by a very, very well-off oil guy from around the, you know, the Gulf. But anyway, I want to say that first point that I ever found that I remember was that little paddle drill that fell out of that site. And then we put together a little frame, a couple of frames of points from that place. There was lang trees. There was a lot of mid and late archaic stuff that you would, pretty typical of the Texas Hill Country, that you would see come out. My dad found a yellow lang tree, and then he found a perfect root beer lang tree out of there. There was a heavy lang tree site.
Mm. That's terrible.
It, right? And he had, there was Castroville's in there, there was Montel's. All the stuff that we go after, it had it.
Yeah.
Everything you want to see in a camp.
It had it.
That's kind of how that place I was telling you about prior to starting the podcast, that's how that was. And it was funny when we stumbled upon that. You know, we've had a lot of private access over the years, and my dad and I were talking one day, and we're like, man, I would love to have access to a camp that's just Montel's and Castroville's. I mean, everybody's, if you're a Texas collector, that's what you're looking for, a lot of people. And sure enough, we go out there, and that's pretty much all we were finding. So it's rough times when you get into something like that.
Oh, it is. And, you know, the square Castroville is one point that I've been after a very long time. And I don't know if I'll ever find one.
You will.
People don't understand how hard it is to find a squarier type Castroville that's in perfect condition with some size to it. Is literally almost the equivalent of finding like an andesite that's intact.
Yeah,
they're that hard.
I'll show you one from the camp that we were talking about. When we're done, it's broken, and I broke it more. But it's there was two pieces out of that site that made my stomach turn when I found them. You know, just the what if, and that Castroville and my broke corner tang from there. I'm pretty certain whole it would have been a 5-inch squared Castroville. It's insane.
That's like, one in a million piece if you found that. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, I've been fortunate with at least squared Castrovilles. I found two in one day at Twin Elm. One is completely whole root beer. The other one is made out of some tan, like gravel type stuff, but it's missing one ear.
I remember the full one you got from out there.
Yeah. Ah, man, that piece is awesome. And there's a funny story with that is J. Mike had gone out there with us that weekend, and he was staying with us at the hotel and stuff. Anyway, when me and Mike are digging together, we kind of one-up each other, just jacking around, you know, being goofy. And I pulled that piece off the screen, and I was going to go show Mike because he was digging with another guy. And Mike was coming to me to show me a piece he had just found. And he's like, I got a killer, dude. And I was like, it ain't as killer as this one. He's like, I bet it is. And I'm holding mine in my palm, and he's holding his in his palm, and he gets to me. He's like, show me yours. And I was like, no. And I was like, I just want to see the disappointment when I open my hands. So show me yours first. And he opened it up, and it was, he had a really nice purd. And I was like, yeah, I got you beat, buddy. And I opened it up, and he's like, God dang you, dog. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike gets.
That'd be most people's reaction seeing a nice Cacheville like that.
Yeah. So your first, as far as you can remember, is a paddle drill?
Yeah. It was so many years ago, you would think that, you could remember your very first point. I was younger at the time, and it was so many years ago that I remember it specifically, but I also don't, because mm-hmm. it was just way too many years ago, and there's been so many different artifacts in the last 11 years I've been digging. It's just kind of hard to recollect way far back with what... I could show you the frame, and I know the artifacts that came out of there. I could sit there and name a majority of them, but knowing which one of those fell out first, I just couldn't tell you. It was just a very heavy mid to late archaic camp.
Yeah. Your story digging is very similar to mine, too. I mean, when I was a kid, my dad took me to a site that they had had access to for years and hand dug. And, I was a kid. I didn't know what I was doing. I'd get in there and poke around. But 30 minutes in, I'd get bored. Well, then in high school, which is about – it would have been 2014 or 2015. I'd have to look at my phone and see is when I really got into digging. And pretty much the same as far as finding a point. Remembering what my first piece was, that camp, and it's, my gosh, I hope one day that we can dig it again. Very minimally touched, and I mean the occupation in it, it's got a bird layer that's 2.5-3 foot deep, and then you get under that and you get into Enzers and Darls, and then you get under that and you get into Williams and Castorvilles and Montells, and just exceptional site too. But we were primarily digging in the top layer of that and the bird layer, and I know I found a couple, half-assed points here and there, but the first one I really remember, I know I was talking to my dad and I said I wanted to find something with some good color in it, and I popped out a little red and white bonum that's striped. That's the first point that I really remember finding, kind of the same thing as you. I know I found some more before that, but that's the one that I know was that I can call my first point. Mm-hmm.
I know that we didn't dig that camp deep enough. We were amateurs.
Yeah,
especially me. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. Went in there with a shovel, started out with the wrong tools, and we're talking. We were diving down only about 2 feet at most.
Yeah.
If you looked at this camp, you put your mind like you think about it like back in ancient times. It was picture perfect. It was absolutely a beautiful setup. A huge grove of trees on a flat plain about 100 yards away from the river with easy enough access to it just in the open there. And I'm talking, this is the Savinel. It had like the deep sections of the Savinel. It was a ranch that I just dream of owning. But I can guarantee you, knowing what I know now, we didn't touch it.
Yeah.
We could have gone down and probably started finding early archaic pieces.
Yeah,
I'm willing to bet that there was plenty of Andeis Bell culture mm-hmm. that was below all that, and we scratched the surface.
Yeah,
that mm-hmm. camp, I would just still say it's untouched.
Yeah,
That's
something we're kind of hoping that this podcast will allow people to realize, especially if you're new into the hobby. I mean, and everybody that's dug has done it. Dig to the bottom. Dig until you hit that hard pan or that clay line and know you're getting everything. Yeah, it may be hard, but it's worth it when you're in a really good camp, especially. And depending on situation, I mean, there's places that we've dug that we know, hey, we're not going to be able to have the time to dig all that stuff. But if things were right, if you've got access to a camp to really dig it right, dig it right. Dig it all the way to the bottom and find everything. So you were talking about in that you knew y'all weren't digging it correctly, mainly tools and not digging deep enough. That brings up another point. I know you mentioned you hand dig and you screen dig. When you're hand digging, what are the tools that you carry with you? Because that's not something we've really talked about on here much. I think we've mentioned it in some videos, but what are your go-to hand digging tools?
Pickaxe.
Yeah.
That's the 100% main tool that I use. And I don't even go in there, and everybody has a different technique. My technique going with a pickaxe that was specially made And it's probably only, I could have brought it. It's probably only about 20 inches in length. And the upper part where the pick part is, where it gets sharp, is very narrow to where you can get it into the rock easily. And it's that part, that portion's probably like 16 inches. Mm-hmm. So it's probably like a 16 by, I don't know, 20, 25. It's just very easy to maneuver and handle. Mm-hmm. It's not, doesn't have long portions to it where it's, you get down in there easy. And it's, it was, the size of it was specifically made for me, and I asked him to put it at those lengths.
Mm-hmm.
And it's they're pretty common. I mean, you know, you guys have the pickaxes.
Yep.
I mean, anybody that hand digs is probably going to have one of those. I just don't like the super wide the part
stinger
at the top. I don't like them where it's overly wide. It's just too hard to get in there and get in that rock, and it's more metal exposure.
Yeah.
The less metal exposure you have going into the ground, the better.
Yeah.
That's why, on a side note, I hate when they use excavators on professional digs. You're adding, you know, they use the excavator to go in there to make it easier for the skid steer to come in after to pick up the dirt. It's doubling and tripling
yep.
the metal exposure to damage those artifacts. It's mm-hmm. terrible. So anybody who's got a professional pay dig out there, I would urge you, I would beg you, do not use an excavator. Anyway, the pickaxe is the main thing. You know, I don't even start with a shovel. You know, you would think a lot of people would start in the ground just using a shovel. Where I go and hand dig, I have to fill the hole back in every time.
Oh, boy.
And it makes it extremely difficult. And it takes time to start the hole. That's the hardest part. Every time you go back to the site, starting a new spot. Not really even new, connecting to where you were.
Right.
You know, but you have to dig all that back out again and keep going.
Mm.
And there's different depths, you know, to the camps. The mm-hmm. average depth of the camp that I dig is about 2.5, maybe 3 feet. And it gets deeper as you get into where the main midden ring is. Mm-hmm. It dives down to depths of around maybe 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hit that limestone plate and you know you're at the bottom.
Yep.
There's nothing below those limestone plates.
Yep.
And, you know, for me, the easiest tool is a simple pickaxe, a very specialized tool that's used to get in there to crack those walls off without touching, you know, using too much metal.
So you're using it basically like a wiggle pick?
A wiggle pick, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of people make them out there. There's a few different styles,
yeah.
different handles on them. This one doesn't even have a handle. I use one that just has, I get in there and I'm using my hand, my palm of my left hand to get in there and just maneuver itself. Well, some people have the handles on mm-hmm. them. I don't use them. There's ball handles and you got the tubular, you know, other types of handles on there. Mine's easy. It's lighter weight and it's easy for me to get in there and knock those walls off. That's what I use. Hand digging is just, it's a totally different ball game. You got to mm-hmm. find your own rhythm. And the other thing is, when you're hand digging, you have to get down and come from underneath. Knock the wall out from underneath.
Yep.
And I've made the mistake of breaking a few artifacts. It's also inevitable. We can't see, obviously. Nobody can see what's in the ground. Mm-hmm. So whether it's at the most bottom portion of the dirt at the plate or whether it's in the middle... But it's easiest if you're knocking from the bottom to knock that wall off.
Yep.
You at least minimize the chance of damaging something.
Right.
So that's all I use. One tool.
Really?
To do the whole thing.
You don't take a shovel at all?
I don't even take a dang shovel.
Really?
I don't even take a dang shovel.
That's impressive.
I literally start with the pick itself right at the top. There is some arrow points in that camp. And... it takes enough out because the camp's not super deep. So mm-hmm. it doesn't take a super long time to get it going again. You can get your rhythm and it's, I don't know. It's just that's just my routine.
Hmm.
Everybody's got their own, but that's mine.
So are you making like a continuous wall? I couldn't say wall, but
yeah.
Are you kind of popping a hole next to that hole or are you kind of just going
it
in
depends.
Different areas?
If I'm both. Right. Sometimes I'll start a completely different spot,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes I'll run off of a pre-existing hole that I had where I filled it back in.
Hmm.
That you can kind of, right where you filled it in, get that edge going a little easier.
Right.
But both. This isn't a huge camp. The place I've been digging, you know, up towards Bell County, I've been digging it for a while, and there's two different camps, both sides of the ranch. And one side I can't go to anymore. You know, it's been off limits, but I found a camp on the other side. And unfortunately, the camp on the other side doesn't have Ocala's. The first camp I was digging back in like 2018 and 19 had a bunch of Ocala's in it. Mm. And I love the Ocala style points. Mm. But it's weird. You would think that the Ocala's would be 2 miles away.
Yeah.
They're not there. Mm. You know what I mean? So that culture wasn't making them over there. But they lived in that other camp on the other side. So it's weird. But mainly, there's really hardly any early archaic at this place. And it's all pretty much mid and late archaic stuff. Yeah. Heavy Marshall, Purd, and transitional presence. Mm. Enzers, Darls, Fairlands, Zephyrs, all that. All that last of the atlatl stuff, all through like the Marshall people. That's where a lot of that stuff was coming.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it. So, but anyway, answer your question. One specific tool, one single wiggle pick, that's all I use.
So, I know the past 5 years is about what you've been making content. And people that know of you have seen some of the exceptional pieces that you and Miss Gina have pulled out. That being said, prior to your content making, what were some of those really significant finds that maybe you look back at and you're like, dang, I wish I had a camera then, or dang, I wish I was recording? Because I know I've got a few of them myself that I wish, if I'd have taken 5 seconds just to pull my phone out and hit a little short, I'd still have that memory.
You know, there's two finds that I didn't get on video prior to when I started taking videos of anything that we were finding. The first one was her Kerrville knife that she found. So there was two Indian Creek digs. Tanner had his.
Yep.
Then you ran about 2 miles down that same creek, Clint had his.
Yep.
She found, this is kind of when she was new getting into the artifact world. She said, I think I got something pretty nice. And she put it's the nicest Kerrville knife I have ever seen. And it, in fact, it made it into the Texas Best of the Best book.
Really?
It's the first one you see on the new book.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, you'll have to go look at that. and fantastic, just beautiful. I didn't get that on video because she had already taken it out of the pile and handed it to me, and I already had lost my mind. I forgot phones even existed at that point. I was just staring at that artifact. That's one. The other one is actually the point that is on my the monolithic picture itself, that Martindale.
Yeah.
That came out of Logan's dig out in Barksdale, which outside of Twin Elm, the Twin Elm for Tanner's and that Barksdale dig when Logan, cause there was multiple operators that were on that ranch prior to Logan. Yeah. Logan went back out and reopened that place. And it had some of the finest early archaic pieces I've ever seen in my life.
Yep.
Come off that place.
Yep.
And so that Martindale would be the second one I didn't get on camera. Mm.
How early into Logan digging that? Was that his first site? And was how early into the dig?
That was Logan's first site. And that day, I think it was the first day we were there. It was either the first day or the second day I was out there. I think it was the first, though. Literally the first time Logan. We had a test dig that day.
Yep.
Logan got a group of about, I don't know, it was like 12 people out there, maybe. Maybe about 12 people, 14 people. And we tore into the side of that hill that was right there. And Gina found, we found a laguna. She found a laguna. She found one of the most gorgeous bandies I've ever seen. I found that Martindale. She found a killer blade. That day that's the best day we've ever had on a pay dig.
Yeah.
And for me and her going digging personally, that is the best day I've ever seen on a screen. Logan reopened that place and it's just spit out killer after killer after killer of literally some of the best early archaic pieces I've seen found in Texas.
No doubt. No doubt. I know the first time I dug with Logan out there, I think it was either the second or the third weekend. That day in the first load, I found broke andice. I found 5 broke andice in one day. My uncle found a 99% whole, I mean, extremely nice bell. It's just missing the tiniest bit of the tip. The same day, another extremely nice bell came out. Roland Buckley, his wife, found an eccentric andice that day, which we had him on. That's Sharkwater Outdoors. Y'all check him out. Yeah, I got to see some incredible pieces come out of that place. And then his second site that he dug about a year later, that one was also really good. That day I seen an exceptional bell come out too. So some of the best, like you said, early archaic that I've seen come out of anywhere.
Literally some of the best early archaic. And not only that, so after that dig finished where all that early stuff was coming from, we paused, and then Logan asked me, he says, hey, I need you to come and help me test this spot across the creek. So him and I went out there with the machine and tested that other side, and that's where eventually all that killer paleo stuff started coming out of. One of the best Angosturas, one of the best Wilsons, one of the nicest like Plainview style points, one of the a killer Golondrinas. I mean, shocked us all because you don't normally see killer paleo artifacts in the Texas Hill Country per se. They can be found out there, but it's kind of rare to find extremely super killers that consistently in one spot in the Hill Country.
Yeah,
they were coming out of there, which kind of blew our mind. But on the it really blew our mind because on the test dig we didn't see paleo coming out. We were just seeing some of that, you know, like Castrovilles and some Enzers and stuff like that. But when it shifted into a different spot, those killer paleo started popping. That ranch and that dig was just spectacular.
Yeah, that place, it's got so many camps on it and
still stuff left.
Still. So that being said, what kind of got you to want to start Monolithics? What was the purpose behind it and what really started it?
You know, so November of 2020, this is during COVID, I just thought, you know, I'm digging. Why not video this stuff and just start posting it online for people to kind of see how this stuff works? Really, people don't get the opportunity to do what we get to do. It's a blessing. It can end at any time, but it's a pure blessing. And to be able to go out there and do this, well, people, I get so many people now reach out and say, I love the video, love the content. Thank you for posting this stuff. They don't get the opportunity to do this.
Yeah.
This kind of just brings people right in, you know? So I started filming around 2020 pretty heavily. Late 2020. But how it really started was I just kind of started with just posting a nice picture of points, you know, no music, no background, just posting some of the points I had found prior to 2020. And from there, man, the rest is history. It got into, you know, doing from just posting the finds of me down in the hole, hand digging, you know. And the beauty about that is people can see a little bit of the context.
Yeah.
And nothing against what we do on screen digs. We all love doing that, but people don't understand there's a big difference between the two.
Yes.
The hand digging gives you the major context, and the context is extremely important. You know, getting to see the exact level of which an artifact comes out and getting to document the site, taking your own notes, you know. It kind of got into that, and then it got into some of the occasional voiceovers and more educational videos and content, and I was getting some positive feedback about that stuff. And then even from that, a few people reaching out asking if I could take their find and just do a voiceover on that. So there was, I don't know what Monolithics in the course of the long run, what it's going to fully be. It's just going to be a variation of different things like it's been. And it's been fun. You know, it's just nonstop pursuit of ancient lost history. And it gives a chance for people to see what we get to do here.
Yeah. What I really like about what you've done with it is bring the educational side to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Christian and I, when we first started the podcast, we talked about doing stuff like that, but then we seen you started doing it and I was like, hey, we're gonna stay out of it, you know. When we do our to the points, we'll kind of dive into what the culture was that made that point, but that's really it. I really like that standpoint, and I think that's something a lot of people should look into doing that are making content. And like you said with hand digging too, you get to see the context where the artifacts are being found. And even like if we're running a video on a screen dig, that's something I'm trying to go back to the wall, show what the occupation layer looks like, explain where things are coming out, why they're coming out there. And yeah, I really appreciate that you bring that side of it to it, because a lot of people just look at them as Arrowheads. So yeah, when you can tie the cultures into it, tie the occupation, show them the occupational signs, because that's a common question too. I mean, I know when I'd post a lot of videos hand digging, well, what do y'all do to find these sites? What is the signs you're looking for? Things like that. So showing them that sign in context to the artifact immediately is cool.
Yeah.
I would say that it's helped me a lot too, because coming into this, you know, it's only a couple of years ago really, so since I've actually been really getting into it, I'd say watching some of the videos that you posted has taught me a lot, just because sometimes I don't want to go read that book. Sometimes I don't want to go look at the pictures, and just seeing that constant content and kind of the, especially being in the area that you're from, you know, you go look at some of the points and you're like, man, I don't even know what that is, because you're not used to seeing it. And then you see the stuff and you're like, oh, okay, that looks familiar. That's what that is. So, you know, for me, it's helped a lot. Awesome. So I could say I appreciate that.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And like he said, you know, a lot of the books you go and read too, when you get into typology of Arrowheads, a lot of it, I think, is opinionated. I mean, you talk to one person and one person's got an opinion as to why it's this. I mean, as far as person to person. So depending what book you read, it may be contradicting opinions on what's being said about the point type. So I like that you give a pretty straight, you know, description of why you think it's that point type. What do you think was associated with that point, the age, all that stuff. Things that most people just aren't doing, you know, instead of, and even my videos, you know, a lot of it's hee-hawing and cussing and just the excitement of the point. So to slow it down and actually bring the clear data to the points is really neat. So just wanted to give you that little shout.
Awesome. I appreciate the feedback. It's important. Of course, you get so many videos out there, and archaeologists, we get it all the time. They're like, you know, you're looting these signs. I understand, obviously, it's easy for them to think that. But the fact of the matter is, they wouldn't know these sites even existed. And nothing against, I love archaeologists. We need it.
Yeah.
And there's so many untouched sites that are still out there that we will never find.
Right. Right.
The places that we're hitting, I mean, they just never knew that these sites even existed. And they probably would have never known these sites existed. And to me, it's getting in there and it's saving things that, in my opinion, would have never have been found.
Yeah. I think, too, and I don't want to speak on behalf of an archaeologist. I'm not an archaeologist. The only real archaeologist we've had any discussion with is David. But I think a lot of these sites that we dig aren't sites that would have been significant to the archaeological record. When you get, and I've heard it from a few archaeologists that we've talked to, when you get into sites that have wash layers and stuff like that, when the context is not clearly in place as it should be, you start running into issues documenting that. Now, I've, you know, we talked with David at Temple, and he talked about a site at the Laguna Montel where I believe it was Martindale culture. Was it Martindale or was...
Yeah, I think so.
It was either Martindale or maybe it was St. Mary's Hall. But they brought in 5.5 feet of gravel into their camp and placed it because they were finding whatever the point type was. I can't remember exactly. Whatever it was in context below the gravel line. And then they brought it in and then they were finding points above it. It wasn't a flood layer. It wasn't anything like that. They physically brought in the gravel. So, you know, that showed that. But a lot of the sites that I've dug in, they have flood deposit and they have this and that. And context is mixed up and jumbled a little bit. And in the grand scheme of things, some of these sites aren't big enough or contain enough archaeological context that it would be significant anyways.
Right.
So I think a lot of that can be nipped in the butt. But there, I mean, there are definitely sites that need to be documented and things. Like Jonesboro, for example, that's a once-in-a-lifetime site, and it now has an archaeological site number to it. There's a reason.
Absolutely. Oh, Jonesboro. Shout out to Todd Dodds, by the way. I absolutely love him. He's such a good guy. But that site, like you just said, what an exceptional place. Yeah. That whole thing was start to finish.
Yep.
I mean, that one, there's so many. The Hog Eye with Gene.
Yep.
These sites that have been operating for 6 years, yep. 5-6 years.
Daily.
Being heavily dug with how much has come out of both of these sites. I mean, these are like generational sites that these people, they had everything they needed. And it must have been trade routes or something where everything, you know, just everything was perfect
yeah.
at these places. And there's so many of each type that it was just absolutely incredible, all the way from paleo to your transitional archaic stuff, all that bow and arrow stuff, and so much of it.
Yep.
And it just, some of these sites just blew me away. And but the cool part is that a lot of the public got to have a part of that, right. you know, participate in that.
Yep.
And most of these people don't get the chance to go into private places. So to be able to offer the public a chance to go do this is just, to me, it's pretty incredible.
So kind of gone over all these different sites that you've been able to be a part of and, you know, some of the greater finds that you've had out there. Could you talk about a few more of those, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I brought some here so you guys can kind of see these firsthand. But let's talk about that stone and the bone first.
Okay.
We'll get that out of the way.
Yeah, this is a.
Yeah.
This is it.
So this piece came out in was it April of 2022, I believe. And there it is.
You still have it exactly as is.
It's exactly as is. So. And I'll hand this over to you guys in a minute. I'll just talk on it for a second. But this is at the site I dig. I've been digging for the last six years. And I was sitting there digging about 20 feet from the main midden ring where the rise was. And I was going kind of in the direction of downwards on the bluff where the creek was down at the bottom there. And I was getting away from the midden. And I was about a foot and a half down. And I busted this piece. I cracked that wall off, and this piece just rolled out. And I looked at it for a second, and I go, is this a bone with a stone artifact going up inside the bone cavity? And literally is what this was. And I've left this intact till this day. And out of every find I've ever had, this was the one that was the head-scratcher for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because... there's a lot of people that dig in Texas, and I'm kind of hoping somebody else finds something similar, to be quite honest.
Yeah,
right.
Because it'll help us connect that dot a little closer. Being a one-off is a little bit tough to say. What were they doing? This wasn't right. by accident.
Yeah.
This thing goes up inside this cavity about another, probably another inch. You can't see it. We did some x-rays on this, and you could see... And Ryan Murray with Texas Cache did a fantastic write up on this artifact and one of his two years ago when he came out with it, and it's four full pages, and I have this has not been taken out of this bone.
Yeah,
all the original soil contents, everything has been left as is. This is a deer humerus bone,
mm-hmm.
and this stone drill is going up inside this thing. So it makes you wonder, well, were they obtaining the bone marrow out of this? Well, then you ask, well, why didn't they just crack it open?
Yeah.
Why mm-hmm. were they using a stone drill to go up inside of this thing? Well, maybe was this a protective sheath that they would just put this? There's three things that I've heard that this could be. The first, a protective sheath for the stone, the bit of the drill. It was just in here to protect the bit, and then when they needed to use it, I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
The second thing, were they just obtaining the bone marrow out of this thing? Possibly, because bone marrow was used for nutritional purposes, we know. The third, was it hafted this way with sinew wrapped around this, where they were using the end of this pedernales on the stem side as some sort of just a cutting device?
Hmm.
Which... I don't think so. I think that they were going to utilize this bone for something else, and they mm-hmm. were just trying to get that marrow out of here.
That's
right. I was thinking potentially making it a handle for something.
Yes.
To put something inside.
Handle could, or an awl, maybe?
Yeah, it Start could be that. Awl. Absolutely. So none of us know. It's all speculation.
Right.
But what is odd is that it rolled out exactly as you see it right
mm-hmm.
here. And I'll even let you guys see that if you want to see it.
And I know... I'm sure when that came out, you got a lot of... Did you get a lot of flack on it? Like, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you know, people were like, oh, you put that in there. You know, it's... There was a little confusion. I didn't want people to think that it was... It had penetrated the actual bone itself. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the animal had been injured from it. No, they right. were going into the bone cavity, which is right where the marrow's at.
That makes you wonder also kind of what they were doing for it to be in that position.
Yeah.
Like something happened where they had to leave or it got stuck. You know, there's no...
It's just...
wish you knew the story.
It's a mystery.
You know?
It's a mystery, but that's right. The cool thing about it is the mystery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? Exactly. And to this day, you know, if I pull this thing out, obviously I could put it right back in, but to me the idea of having the matrix, all the original contents from the camp dirt itself,
yeah,
I just want to leave this thing intact, because mm-hmm. if I pull it out, we all know what a Pedernales drill looks like. Those are pretty much a dime a dozen, but to be connected, I'm just going to leave this as it was found.
Yeah, that's an incredible piece, and the speculation on what it could be, and it now holding it too and looking at it and the way the drill is actually in the bone, I don't know.
It's definitely, it's very unusual.
Yeah.
It's a very unusual piece, and yeah, so, you know, that was 3.5, almost 4 years ago that thing came out, and that was one of the more unusual pieces that came out of the site I dig now outside of it. It's very heavily Pedernales and Marshall people, and which is very common of what we find here in Texas in the Hill Country. But on that same site, I brought this piece for y'all to see as well. This is the boat stone that just came out. When did you find that? That was about 2 months ago, 2.5, something like that. She had come out there doing a little digging, and she said, I think I got something here. And this is how this video went down online, by the way. People are like, you planted it. No, it was not planted at all. She knocked it out of the wall, and she was only about 1.5 feet, maybe deep. And I was digging in a different location, 10 feet away, two different holes, and she said, I think I got something here. She turned that thing. I about lost it. I said, that's a freaking boat stone. I said, I can't believe you found that. So I said, set that right back down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she put this down. I had not seen it up close. So I came up with the phone and started filming. And it was turned over. So when I brought the camera in, which is when everybody else gets to see it right on camera, that was the first time I saw it up close. I about lost it, and I did lose it. I couldn't believe it was made that well.
Oh, yeah.
It was – that is a just how they – and it, I know people are like – they like to see arrowheads and the shapes of the arrowheads and the barbs and the ears and people. But when it comes to hardstone artifacts in mm-hmm. Texas
– yeah.
These are just kind of one in a million, even though there's been like three of them found.
This year.
Like, yeah.
It's the year of the boat stone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. But this and this stone drill going up inside this bone are pretty much the two most unusual things that have been found from that site.
Yeah.
And it was special. I mean, honestly, finding a boat stone like that, and I just couldn't believe it came out. I was like, I just couldn't believe it.
It's just like so symmetrical, the way it's made, so nice. It's hard to believe that they had that sort of technology to do it the way they did.
Absolutely. And people don't understand. It takes a long time to shape these rocks like this.
Especially mm-hmm. material like that. I mean, that's some type of... It almost looks like a granite,
but it's
more like a concrete type material.
It is. It's an odd material. Yeah.
Very cool. It's got a lot of granite appearance to it, but it's definitely just some type of probably river concretion or something.
Something.
But
it's I don't know what the exact material is, but it's extremely symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they cranked out an arrowhead in an hour or two back in ancient times. That I guarantee you. Took way longer to make than a typical arrowhead. So anyway, just those are the two most unusual things as far as, you know, the hand digging. But other unusual rare finds that we don't see is going back to Logan's site, Trade Point, that Gina found off that site. And pretty remarkable because the... we should have brought that, actually. Should have brought that, too. But it's a smaller one. And the beauty about that trade point is that It was one of the ones that was actually melted down by the natives themselves at the time. And that point's probably only 150 to 200 years old.
Yeah.
You know, back in historic times, I would even guess it like Comanche or the Tonkawa Indians.
Yeah, whoever, something you can actually associate
something
it
with. Everybody's always asked, well, what tribe is this? What tribe is that? On everything that we're finding. Mm-hmm. Well, yep. People don't know the historical or the archaeological timeline. This stuff that we find has no names.
Yeah.
These are just eras of history. You know, late prehistoric, archaic, or transitional archaic, you know, late archaic, mid archaic, early, all the timeline. Well, at least finally you can ask that question and we can answer it with a trade point.
Yep.
It was connected to Indians that we have names of within the last 200 to 300 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's the beauty about the one she found, is that it wasn't one of the ones done by one of the blacksmiths that have those rigid lines on the stems. Those were made in numbers. This one in particular was literally melted down by those tribes themselves and formed.
Huh.
So very unusual, very cool piece. And yeah, it came right off the site where all that stuff, all that early archaic stuff was coming from.
Yeah, those trade points are, like we were talking about before this, you know, they're pieces. I mean, just like all those pieces you just pulled out, the bone with the drill in it, the boat stone, I mean, they're pieces you don't expect to see ever come out, especially central Texas to the hill country, or kind of like you were talking about with Dylan's off the coast. Like, you just don't expect that material to survive. And just like with the drill, you don't expect that material to survive intact. You know, you just don't see it. You don't see it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Amazing pieces.
Yeah, thank you. So out of all the thousands of artifacts recovered over the last, you know, decade, a little over, these are more unusual. I would say, you know, we could sit there and look at stone points all day, but outside of the stone artifacts, I would say the other unusual find I had was a 5-hole drill gorget that came out of Indian Creek.
Really?
The Twin Elm. Mm. That came out of, you know, that site was fantastic too, which I think Tanner should it's too slow for Tanner, but I think he should reopen it. I think there's more there, and he knows there's more there, but for him it slowed up too much. But anyway, yeah, that gorget was cool. But then going back into just all the stone artifacts, you just get into it from there, you know, finding any type. And one thing, the last one I'll mention outside of the projectile and arrowheads, was a broken cloud maker pipe that also Gina found.
You found that?
Well, it came out in multiple, like two, basically it might have been three pieces of it. But putting them together, not only was it a cloud maker pipe that they had bored and drilled out perfectly, they had incise markings and designs all over it.
Really?
And it was, even just having the two fragmented pieces of that go together is just super cool.
Yeah.
Couldn't find the other pieces, but it was two pieces that fit together that gave you an idea of what it would have looked like.
Yeah.
And so that was unusual. It's, yeah, man, that's what I love about it.
Yeah.
We don't know what the next churn of the dirt's going to be.
Yeah. What about a more recent find for you, that obsidian piece off of Rocky Creek?
I forgot about that. Just because there's so many digs that go on. Yeah, so the Rocky Creek thing, I had gone. That's the first time I had gone to. It might have been the second. I think I'd been out there maybe two or three times total now. It might have been the second trip I was out there. I was screening with Logan that day, and the second load of the day, I had that one on camera. I filmed that one. And I said, Logan, I think that there's an obsidian point here, man. Like, and he walks over there. He's like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. So I get this thing on camera, and volcanic glass point. Of course, it was missing part of that tip, but the whole stem and both of its ears were all fully intact. And for us to find, you know, obsidian in Texas, I talked to Tom Hester about this. He sent it off.
Yeah.
He sent it to the University of Missouri for XRF testing because he said that particular lab is the best place to do it. They got the best technology to source exactly where that material is coming from. And I got the point back pretty quick. I Tom Hester doesn't live far from me at all. He's like 10 minutes from my house. Anyway, I went over there, dropped the point off, he sent that to Missouri, and I got that point back, I think, in like 45 days.
Really?
Maybe. It might have been maybe a little less than that. And they got that testing done quick, and it came from the Jemez Mountains of New Mexico. So it was 700 miles away, which is I was kind of hoping it didn't come from the Jemez Mountains, because that's the most typical source of when we do find obsidian here.
Yeah,
it's usually traced to there.
Yeah.
But there's been some out at Jeans. I know that the stuff out there was like from Malad, Idaho, which is coming from distance. It just puts it into perspective that the natives from long ago, they all these trade routes, you know, and trading these materials, there was huge trade networks.
Yeah.
And anyway, so it got tested, and it was from the Jemez Mountains. That was an interesting find.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy to think about how far that material traveled, especially in that time. Because, you know, like we were talking about, people generally ask what tribes were associated with these points. Well, that also associates the horse. And they didn't have horses during these cultures, you know. So that's 700 miles by what? Maybe a dugout? I don't know when dugouts started being implemented going up and down the rivers, but that's a long way. Just like finding alabates in this area and stuff. That even alabates to get here is traveling a long ways.
Oh yeah.
So
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The trade routes were amazing systems back in those days. I mean, you know, without car or horse, it took them a long, long, long time to get to where they were going.
I don't want to walk 700 miles.
Yeah, no.
No. No.
But so I guess, you know, we're kind of getting towards the end of this, but what do you have? I know you said earlier you don't know what the long-term look of Monolithics is, but do you have any goals going forward or anything you're working on? Or,
you know, originally, you know, I couldn't tell myself, I didn't want to charge people for anything I was putting out.
Yeah.
I was like, people don't get to see this stuff anyway, so it's like, just put it out there. So I didn't do any subscriber you know, subscriptions or trying to get people to subscribe to my channel. And it kind of, some of the videos, just that's where, when you start getting videos that run up into the millions of views, that's, and there's only been a handful of those.
Yeah.
Most of the videos don't do that. You know, getting specific, if you want to talk about the platforms, like your average video for people on TikTok might run into 1,000, 2,000 views. If you're lucky, a lot of them don't even reach 1,000 views because TikTok's so flooded with Arrowhead content now. And the algorithms are very different. The TikTok followers, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
A person with 10,000 followers could get more views than a person who has 1,000,000 followers.
Yeah.
Because most people are just flipping through their For You page and they don't even look at the followers tab. So it really comes down to, you know, how engaged your followers are, if they're dedicated and wanting to see every day what you're putting out. But, you know, I don't know where it's going to go yet. It's grown significantly since I started in November of 2020. And really right now, it's just going to continue being a mix of what it is, which is bringing people right there, whether I'm in a dirt hole hand digging where people can see the context, or whether it's sitting there on a hand table where the machine is just bringing us the artifacts. Or it could be the voiceovers, the educational aspect. I'm going to always try to put the giving the age and the type.
Yeah.
I know it gets old saying, okay, he just posted a Pedernales a couple of days ago. Well, I'm going to continue. If I find three perds, I'm going to do 3 days of posting perds.
Yeah.
And putting the same information, how old it is, you know, mid to late archaic, it's all going to go out there.
Yeah.
Because people, that's the most important part of it all.
Yeah.
Is the history behind it all.
Yeah.
And the information. So I don't know where it's going to go. You know, the goal ultimately was, you know, you're putting thousands of miles, thousands of hours, you know, and thousands of dollars, thousands of miles, thousands of hours into all this. So the ultimate goal is to just generate enough, if you can, just to pay for what you're doing.
Yeah.
The time. Because it gets expensive. People don't know how much time and money goes into going all over these places to do this.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of people get divorced over it.
Yeah. Yes, it can be addicting. And for me, I'm not married, and you know, Gina likes to go do this stuff, so it's fun when you have two people that love to do it and go do it. But, you know, there's really, fortunately for me, I don't have any kids. That's the big thing. I know a lot of people out there have kids and they have a lot of other obligations and their time's limited. Well, outside of work for me, my time's not too limited.
Yeah.
So I really have a lot of time I can put towards doing this kind of stuff. And anyway, it's just been adventure after adventure. And Texas has so many places that we can go. It's just like, I don't know where next weekend's going to be.
Yeah. And especially in, it seems like this year, kind of like we were talking about with the boat stones, this has been the year of the boat stone. It's been the year of new digs. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been new operators right and left. I mean, Cole had a dig going. New guy right here locally, Seth, he's got digs, multiple digs mm-hmm. going. Spencer's got digs going, plus the guys that have been going, you know, Mike, Quade, some stuff popping up in the hill country a little bit, mm-hmm. Clint Beckham. Tanner's always behind the scenes working on stuff, but
that punk, he's always just digging the richest private sites. It's crazy. I'm happy for him, but it's like a good jealousy. You know?
Did you see what he found on Friday?
I did not.
Oh boy. I'm not going to talk about it on here.
Oh boy.
Yeah. It's insane.
I'll have to hit him up.
It's a one in a million piece in the hill country.
I'm really going to have to hit him up.
It's probably more rare than that boat stone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's
now incredible. You got my interest here. I'm going to have to see what's
when we're off camera. I'll tell you what it was. He sent me a Snapchat of it. He didn't even know what it was yet. And I was like, dude, that's this. And he got done digging and he's like, dude, you're right. I didn't even know what it was.
Oh boy.
It's sick.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we're kind of getting to that point, huh?
Yeah. Well, man, it's been awesome. Thanks for having me. I know you guys have a lot of material you cover and it's just kind of fun to get on here and talk about artifacts with y'all.
Yeah, man, we appreciate the heck out of it. Like we were saying beforehand, you know, especially in Texas, you're one of the OGs to content creating as far as artifacts go. You were there early and you stuck with it and you're putting out the right content, in my opinion.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. You got anything you want to say?
No, I just appreciate everything that you do and appreciate you coming here today, talking about all this good stuff with us. And I guess we're going to wrap it up. Y'all make sure you keep living your hobbies. We'll see you on the next one.
See y'all later.